Welcome to another episode of The Odd Couple with frenemies Steve Weiss and Jim Labenthal. I'm Jim Labenthal. This is the week of February 14th. Happy Valentine's Day to everyone, although the markets are not showing us much love today. In a second, we're going to give you our updates on the market overall, but we're going to spend the bulk of our conversation today with a very special guest. And viewers of the sitcom The Odd Couple will remember that Jack Klugman and Tony Randall would on occasion have very special guests come on board, like Howard Cosell. And today is one of those episodes. We've got the chief executive officer of Cleveland Cliffs, Lorenzo Gonsalves, joining us. So we're going to do a quick update on the markets overall, and then we're going to get right into what should be a very robust discussion. If you know Lorenzo, you know it's going to be robust. Steve, I'll let you start with the economic and markets overview. And as long as you don't force me to come in and correct everything, maybe we can do that pretty quickly. We'll see. But I'll give it to you, Steve.
Thanks, Jim. And it's unlikely you'll have to correct me because I intend to repeat nothing of what you've said in the past about the markets of the economy. So my view hasn't really changed. I've been pretty bearish in the market over the last few months and continue to bounce between 70% and 50% cash. I don't have to invest in the public equity markets, which is perhaps unique in the show. I'm not the asset allocator, so I can come and go out of the equity markets as I choose. One of my positions, of course, which I added to comfortably at 16 and change, was Cleveland Cliffs, because I do recognize value, but we'll get to that in a second. In terms of the market, look, this morning you had Lavrov, the Russian who works for Putin, say, hey, there's still a path to negotiation. To me, that's what else would you expect him to say? I'm more concerned, frankly, about what happens after this. I can just imagine the conversation that went on in Beijing between Putin and Xi. And Xi said to Putin, hey, we got your back. Go ahead. Do what you got to do with Ukraine. Why don't you just annex them? And I want to see how it goes. And then as soon as this Olympics thing is out of the way, which is a bust, and I'm sorry we did, we're going to start rattling our sabers over Taiwan, which, like Ukraine to Russia, was once part of you. Taiwan, we own that baby, and so we're going to do what we can to get it back. Let's see what Biden has to do in the face of that. So look, whether it happens or not is not the question. The question is what the market is going to think about it. And this has been a half-empty market for quite some time. It's going to continue to be that way. Layer on the fact that the Fed's going to go through this tightening policy, starting with, I think, 25 bips in March, not 50. And it's going to continue for a while. But guess what? What they're going to be doing is raising rates at a time when they cannot control pricing because it's supply chain driven. Steve Leisman said correctly, there's not one rate increase that's going to go and offload a ship onto tractors. So I have those concerns. Then finally, you take a look at consumer confidence, which had the lowest reading in 10 years since 2011. And 2011 was not a good time for the market. So right now, you have this valuation umbrella that I still believe is too high, that's protecting stocks. I do perhaps more of my work in the private markets at this point, and private valuations have held up. There's a six-month lag. So you're going to start seeing valuations overall continue to decline. And I think with the risk-reward at best being in balance right now, and with every strategist being bullish, I'd rather keep cash, even though it's a depleting asset. So that's my view in the market. However, this happens to be good for commodities. And for if we do, as I believe, which is tighten up on China, or they tighten up on themselves, guess what? That's great for, I believe, a company like Cleveland Cliffs. And I'm still very bullish on the auto cycle. The combination of Volkswagen and Porsche is my biggest position, both for event purposes and because I like stocks at six times earnings. So with that, let's turn it over to our special guest and you, Jim. Why don't you do the preamble?
I will. Good synopsis. Let me only add by saying I really hope that bullets don't start flying, because no matter how you cut it, a Russia versus Ukraine hot war is going to cost lives and a lot of them. So let's hope that it doesn't happen. However, here we are in the markets. We're in 2022. Steve, you and I have spoken about volatility in the markets, and we are experiencing it. And when volatility happens, we get a lot of questions from people. Is the economy tilting into recession? Are we on the precipice of a bear market? Now, on Friday, we got a report from Cleveland Cliffs on their fourth quarter 2021 and full year. You look at these numbers, and they're just fabulous. 10 times the revenue from 2 years ago. EBITDA of $5.3 billion. And the year prior, I think, was about $350 million. I could go through a lot of numbers, but here's the punchline. Cleveland Cliffs is knocking the cover off the ball. So then why is the stock market having such agitation today? And why is Cleveland Cliffs stock having such agitation? I'm not going to ask, and we shouldn't ask Mr. Gonsalves about the shares price of Cleveland Cliffs, but we can ask him about the company's strategy. We can ask him about his outlook on the economy going forward. Lorenzo Gonsalves took over a company that was on death's door. This was approximately 2015. He brought it back from the dead. This is an incredibly vibrant company by virtue of the numbers that I just went through. And I'd like to turn it over to you, Lorenzo, to take the ball as I hand it off to you in whichever direction you like to go. I do know that ESG is a primary focus of yours. If you want to start there, it'll lead us into autos and the economy. If you want to go in a different direction, you can make your own cutback. But welcome, sir, and thank you for joining us on The Odd Couple.
Thank you very much, Jim and Steve, for having me here. I love the format because it will allow us to do one thing that normally we don't do these days, go beyond the headline. What kills companies like mine is that just the headline doesn't do it. I'm not going to Mars. I am not creating the virtual reality of the next 50 years. I am doing something that everybody needs on a daily basis, and they don't even notice until it's not there anymore. Let's start with automotive. Automotive, for a long time, the automotive industry in the entire world, they believed that spreadsheets are reality. And if there's a part in Timbuktu, the part is right here, right now. It was just a matter of bringing the part from Timbuktu to here, and in a blink of an eye, the part would be there. Guess what? That's not true. That's not how things work. As things started to be taken care of like that, that no matter where in the world things are done, they are good as long as they are cheaper, they are the ones that I want. That created a fake reality. And the United States, unfortunately, probably 25 years ago, embarked on that. Now we are bringing back things to the United States because the ports are clogged, the supply chains are too extended. We are relying on countries and origins that really can't do everything that they say they can do. And we're back to the good old United States of America. Automotive is now on the brink of a transformation moment that very few times in the history of mankind we saw happening. Everything is moving from internal combustion engines to electric vehicles. And it's a reality. We can't avoid it. And the reason is very simple. Global warming is real. And CO2 is the main cause for global warming. And tailpipe emissions in the automotive sector, transportation in general, is responsible for 29% of emissions in the United States, CO2 emissions, 29%. The steel industry on itself is responsible for 1% in the United States, just 1%. So we, the steel industry, 1%. Transportation, 29%. But our steel can enable the entire fleet to go from ICEs to EVs. And with the EVs, we are going to knock down a lot of that CO2. If you replace half of the fleet through 2030, it will be 15%, not 29%. If by 2040 this number is 5%, the same thing keeps going. So we are knocking down CO2 in an enormous way. And how about ourselves? We're still reducing emissions ourselves, but even if we shut down the entire steel industry in the United States, we are going to reduce from 1% to zero. So it doesn't move much of the needle. So we are necessary. We are good already. We are going to get better. And we can make one of the biggest, if not the biggest, polluter to be a lot less of a polluter here in the U.S. It's the same thing for the entire world. The numbers are not the same everywhere. It's 1% here in the United States of the total emissions, the steel industry. In China, it's 15%. So China's a lot worse than us. They are doing the same thing. But for us here, we need to expedite. We need to clean up the air. We are the conduits to have this done in a very expeditious way.
In terms of the steel content per EV versus combustion engine, what's the difference? And I'm sure your engineering, which you pride yourselves on justifiably, has something to do that from a competitive standpoint. It's not just, here's the steel, put it in a car. You've got to show how you are the choice.
Exactly right. Let me give you a few numbers that are very easy to memorize. One car, more or less, 1 ton of steel. Of course, if it's a big truck, it's a little more than a ton. If it's a compact vehicle, it's a little less than a ton. On average, one car, 1 ton of steel. For the same car is made with aluminum, they don't need 1 ton anymore. They only need 670 kilos because aluminum is lighter. However, the emissions associated with that 1 ton of steel here in the United States would be 1 ton of CO2. So one car, 1 ton of steel, 1 ton of CO2. That same one car with only 670 kilos of aluminum would be 5.5 tons of CO2. So aluminum lose from the get-go because aluminum is associated with a lot more emissions than steel. Keep in mind, 70% of the cost to produce aluminum is electricity, and electricity is still associated with a lot of coal. So indirectly, you are producing a lot of emissions to get to that car. If you go to more sophisticated materials, I'll give you one more, carbon fiber. It will never be mainstream, but carbon fiber don't even need the 670 kilos of aluminum. You only need 450. But that 450 kilos of carbon fiber will be 10 tons of CO2. So steel is not only the easiest one to produce, the most available material, iron, but also the one that's associated to fewer emissions, particularly here in the United States, because we are way ahead of Europe, way ahead of Japan, way ahead of South Korea, way ahead of everybody else.
In terms of then the performance of the EV and the weight of the steel versus the aluminum, how would you characterize that, or how would you distinguish between the two?
When you go with the EVs against ICEs, you are actually no longer generating CO2 from the fuel. So that's where it's called tailpipe emissions. You don't have the tailpipe emissions anymore. So EVs have no emissions at all. So that's what makes the differentiation. As far as the amount of steel, actually, the electrical vehicle will use a little more steel because the biggest thing for the EV is to protect the battery package. You can't allow the battery package to take fire in a collision or something like that. So you end up protecting more the battery package in the ICE because the ICE doesn't have that. But that's why we have slightly more steel in the electric vehicle. On the other hand, all the fight to take weight out of the ICE vehicle, it was because of consumption in order to reduce the tailpipe emissions. So at the end of the day, that's a problem that doesn't exist in the EV. I don't know if I answered your question, Steve. If not, please ask again.
I was really asking in terms of the batteries.
Oh, don't give him free rein, Lorenzo. We'll be here all day.
Excuse me, Jim, you're interrupting us. In terms of the weight, if the steel weighs more than the aluminum, I get that for the battery cage and the battery box. We're actually looking at a private company that makes it. You got to protect it. Aluminum is not going to protect it. The integrity of aluminum, even in crashes we've seen, is not as good as steel. So if safety is your first requirement, and it should be, you want steel. But just in terms of what it would eat into in terms of the range of the EV having the heaviest steel versus the aluminum, how do we think about that?
Well, we are seeing these mainstream companies that are now developing with Cleveland-Cliffs, the vehicles of the near future, we are seeing ranges that are impressive. More than the range of the vehicles, even though it's a very important thing, we are getting to a range that is no different than the range of an equivalent ICE with gas. You have now $65 billion in this infrastructure bill, has already passed in Congress, $65 billion just to reinforce the electrical grid. And that's basic for the other $7.5 billion that's in the bill just for charging stations. So the idea is to dot the country with charging stations the same way we are populated with gas stations. So you're going to have an equivalent autonomy. You can go on a charge more or less what you go with a tank of gas. And you have the ability to recharge the vehicle the same way you refuel your vehicle with gas. So it's coming, and it's coming soon. And by the way, all these improvements in the electrical grid and all these charging stations that will be built throughout the entire country, they have only one source in the United States, and that's Cleveland Cliffs. We have the only facility in the United States in Butler, Pennsylvania, that can produce steels that we use in these transformers and these charging stations.
All right. You just led to my question, which is simply this. How is the economy right now? You mentioned the infrastructure bill. It's already approved. There's also factories going up or announced everywhere, including Intel about to build a $20 billion plant in your home state. And for all of the good news, whether it's infrastructure or corporate CapEx, this weekend, I fielded a lot of calls from clients saying, hey, wait a second, are we headed into a recession? Look at inflation, look at consumer confidence, look at supply chain bottlenecks. Lorenzo, you are the front line. You are producing steel at your integrated steel company, Cleveland Cliffs. What is your macro view of the economy right now?
It's very positive, extremely positive. It hasn't been as positive as it is right now ever in my entire career. It's more than 40 years than the last 24 here in the United States as CEO of four different companies. We are in a position right now that we can't supply enough to the demand. And the demand that's not being materialized, like, example, automotive, just to stay with automotive, is not materializing because they don't have, they, the clients, don't have other things in order to build the cars. We are in a situation that they can build a car and wait for the microchips to arrive. And they are doing that. But there's a limit for that because they have limitations on their own patios to finish the cars, just waiting for microchips. And that's kind of a clogging the entire system. As this system starts to unclog during, we hope and we expect, and we are seeing indications that this will happen throughout this year, we are going to deliver more and more and more steel. If you go to my financial statements, as we reported in our 10K, you'll see that we have a lot of inventory of steel there. Inventory is, by and large, finished products for the automotive industry, just waiting for them to pull. And they're not pulling, not because they don't have order for cars, but because they don't have enough space to build cars waiting for microchips. It's all being delayed, but by no means we have problems supplying this or supplying that. Electrical steels, Jim, right now, we have more orders that we can handle. The thing hasn't even started. We are discussing with several international car manufacturers and also the American ones on the development of engines for the electric vehicles that in the past, Steve, they're all considered that they would bring from Germany or from South Korea or from Japan. Now they realize they can't count on the port of Los Angeles, Long Beach. They can't count on the ports in the East Coast. They have to build in the United States. So how many suppliers they can have to help them? One, Cleveland Cliffs. That's it. So they have to talk to us. And they are talking to us, and we are developing with them. So unfortunately, the time to mature of these things are not measured in hours. They're measured in years. But we are working with them, and this will come. That's why we work ahead with things like our direct reduction plant in Toledo. When I started building in 2017, people thought I was crazy. Now everybody from ArcelorMittal in Europe, Nippon Steel in Japan, POSCO in South Korea, they are all coming to see what we have because they want to have there. So they'll copy us.
Nice. I want to take the discussion in a slightly more personal direction because leadership is what we're discussing here. You, as I mentioned earlier, took a company that really was headed for bankruptcy. It was just a question whether it was Chapter 7 or Chapter 11. It was headed for bankruptcy, and you resuscitated it. You hived off non-performing, non-core assets. You acquired incredible assets and companies in ArcelorMittal, their U.S. operations, and AK Steel. You have to interact with several different stakeholders. You've got to interact with your employees, with whom you interact with in a certain way. You have to interact with customers, You have to interact with competitors to whom you're selling these non-performing assets years ago. You have to deal with Steve and me, which is probably the easiest of the bunch. Lorenzo, you'll remember I first met you, I believe it was August or September of 2019, and you had some rather heated words for analysts who had disagreed with you. And that was my first introduction to you. And I said, whoa, who is this guy? You seem to have more than one leadership tool, because the way that you interact with analysts, and you did it again on Friday, your conference calls are becoming must listening, by the way, but that's not the same way that you can interact with employees or politicians who are pitting you against China. I'd love to learn a little bit more about your leadership techniques, and in particular, how you pivot from one stakeholder to another when you're interacting with them.
Each one is different. And even within the categories, we have differences. We have people that disagree with us because they have a different opinion, and I respect that. And we have people that disagree with us because they have an opinion, because they don't listen. And these are the ones I have a problem with. I can try to convince my dog to speak if my dog wants to listen to me and pay attention to me. But I can't convince a person that already knows, and they are basically trying to poke holes in what I'm saying, how I'm saying, how funny is my accent as a Brazilian, stuff like that. And that's where my problem starts. So I came from a position that I had to fight my way through. I started working when I was 17 years old to help my brother go to college and to put myself through college and help my family to make ends meet. And I got to where I got here in the United States because I never changed. I keep doing things for the ones I work with and I work for. And I feel that I work not for Steve Weiss or Gene Leventhal or any other shareholders. You guys don't need me to work for you. You guys are your own person on each one's capacity. But my people, the ones that work at the mill, the ones that work shifts for me when I'm sleeping, they are there in the blast furnace, in the hot strip mill. They need me a lot. If I don't fight for them, nobody will. And they are the ones that were left behind when the United States abandoned them, when the United States decided that manufacturing was not for us. Let's do this in Asia. Japan does better. Korea do better. Other countries will learn. Even the Chinese might learn one day. We'll buy cheap from them and life is good. They forgot that the people that were leaving behind here in the Midwest. So I'm bringing pride to these guys that what they do is important. What they do is not just work in a steel mill. What they do, they are building middle class. They are putting kids through college. They are making their families better. They are being able to create an economy that consumes and then moves the economy and moves the wheel. And that's what we forgot in this time that we allowed China to eat our lunch and ignore manufacturing. And they laugh on us. And we were talking before recording start about a country like Taiwan. I learned a lot from the Taiwanese. They are more or less like what I'm explaining here. They need to fight and they need to do things on their own. So that's how I pivot. So it's not a thing that I have to plan. I am the way I am. I believe in middle class. I believe in the ability of someone to self-help. And that's a thing that the United States was the envy of the world. I'm from a time that Taiwanese, Chinese, Japanese, even the Europeans, let alone the Brazilians, everybody would like to be like the Americans. And why we forgot that? We are the best country in the world. We can rescue that. But it starts with the economy. It starts with people making money. It starts with the average Joe and the average Jane making money, being able to take care of their kids, take care of their families. This environmental thing is not a bunch of BS that CEOs blab. It's real. There's opportunity. But we need to grab and work every day to make things happen.
You hear that, Steve?
Yeah, I do hear it.
It's called empathy. I'll send you a definition, Steve, but I don't need to because Lorenzo just gave you a definition.
I'm very empathetic and have noted many times that for people that say inflation's not an issue, try living paycheck to paycheck as 70% of the country does. And it's a real problem when you can't put food on the table, you can't heat your home, you have to decide, is it going to be comfortable enough? How many coats do I have to put on at 60 degrees in the house at 55? It's a major issue. But you make an excellent point, and I was thinking about this earlier today, actually, so it's very timely, is that since I got in the business, which was in 87, 88, at that point, Japan, why can't we be more like Japan? Japan does it better than us, as the Nikkei is trading up to 36,000, only to fall down to wherever it is, not having risen for 20 years, for two decades. Then it was the Koreans. Why can't we be like the Koreans? Look at how they make cars. They're so efficient. Their technology is so good. They do it at such low cost. And then it was China. China's the world's number one economic power, number one manufacturing power. And see how they've fallen. So it's the grass is always greener. Reminds me of when I had somebody work for me who kept saying, I've got an offer from so-and-so. I may go there. And that say, don't do that. And then you come back, say, you know, I think I said, fine. If you think the grass is greener, then go over to that grass. But I guarantee you it's not greener. And that's what happened. So setting up for that question, because of the supply chain, because of the issues that we have with China, with other areas, other countries, geographies, do you think that we'll see that manufacturing will come back here in a bigger way, number one? And do you think that just-in-time inventory, which was such a big thing when it came out 20, 25 years ago, is done now and that people are more willing to build inventory at their plants? And how will that change how you manage your business?
Just-in-time as an idea is a good idea. How to establish a partnership. I'll take the profits, you take the losses. That's the type of partnership that just-in-time was put in place for. Here in the United States, we already, in the automotive business, we already put this to bed. It's not like we are going to eliminate just-in-time, but we're bringing reality to just-in-time. We are going to make money. We are making money, as the numbers prove that, and we will continue to make money. And because of our ability to produce all kinds of steel that go in a car, and because of the fact that we are by far the largest supplier of the automotive industry. By the way, Steve, when I say by far the biggest, we are bigger than the second plus the third. And you need to add the fourth to almost get to our size. So I'm talking bigger, real bigger. There are several different specs of steel in a car. We produce them all. And I was able, call me lucky, my timing is good, call whatever you want. But I was able to buy the two companies that together, they can do everything. So you got the picture, right? So I haven't found a car manufacturer in the United States that took my deal. If you don't want to buy everything from me, I'm not going to sell you anything. So far, so good. So that's why steel prices are going up for the automotive industry.
Why wouldn't an auto manufacturer want to deal with a fully integrated producer? I mean, it's sort of revolutionary that you don't have to break it apart.
That's a great question. So far, they want to deal with me. So I'm good with that. And I want to deal with them as well. But got to be dealing, first of all, in a level of we are equals. There's no such a thing that we are the automotive. We are just a supplier of commodity. There's no commodity in a car. It's all super specified. Everything that goes in a car is highly specified. So there's no commodity. Here in the United States, there are several mills that can produce things like the floor of the car or the rail that the seat goes back and forth. But there's none other than Cleveland Cliffs that can produce the skin, the outer portions of the car, the door, the ceiling. So unless you want a car manufacturer that produces those cars from Mad Max that have no doors, no ceiling, you're going to have to deal with Lorenzo.
And the interesting thing about your business is, because I'm looking at a private investment in ADAS, which is Automated Driver Assistance Systems, you're the same way. Once you're designed into a car, you live with that car for as long as that car is in production. And cars don't change production very often. So you have better visibility than a commodity steel company would have. Is that fair to look at it that way?
It's very fair. But the most important thing, believe it or not, that we continue to educate the automotive industry about is that stop worrying about us. Because us as an industry here in the United States, we are just 1% of the CO2 emission. You are 29%. So I am in the business of helping you. So there's nothing that I can do that will improve my own thing, even though I'm doing a lot. And we don't need to go there. It's a lot of details, a lot of chemistry. Your audience will be really bored. I'll do that with Brian Sullivan when he comes to visit my plant. Brian's a good guy. But I'm going to stay with that. We are helping, we meaning Cleveland Cliffs. We are helping the automotive industry to decarbonize. For a fact, I don't want to go there, but you said we're a big shareholder of a big car manufacturer in Germany. They had problems before. Decarbonizing is complicated. So we are doing for real. Our things are measured. I am probably one of the very few CEOs of big steel companies in the entire world that I haven't stated that I'll be carbon neutral by 2050. Don't know why? Because I have a target for 2022, another one for 2023. I have one for 2030. And it's clear to me that my 2030 will be achieved way before that. And then I'm waiting for that to tell the world when I'm going to be carbon neutral. It will be a lot earlier than 2050. We are setting the tone for the automotive industry throughout the entire world. These big companies that people know the name very well, steel companies in Japan, in South Korea, in Germany, in Austria, in Belgium, France, they are already copying what we're doing here. And they are coming from behind because I have already started.
Do you feel they're partnering with you, Lorenzo, or are they looking at you as a traditional supplier that they can squeeze for price? I hope the former. I hope they're saying, wait a second, Lorenzo can get us where we say we want to go.
No, Jim, they're starting to understand. Years of misinformation leads to that. Here in the United States for a long time, because the United States has a very interesting differentiation in terms of the steel industry. We have 70% of the production through mini mills, through electric arc furnaces. Only 30% goes through the blast furnace route, the integrated route. And the rest of the world is the opposite. The vast majority is integrated. So during a long period of time, it was a belief that everybody would go electric arc furnace because that's the way to be. That's more or less the same thing of moving manufacturing to Asia and saying we are going to be okay. So we're bringing this reality back. How many blast furnaces in Japan were replaced by the big steel mill so far with the EAFs? Zero, because Toyota is too big in Japan. Nissan is too big in Japan. Honda is too big in Japan. They can do it. What about Germany? Same thing because of Mercedes-Benz and BMW. So the blast furnaces are there and they're there to stay. Same thing in France, same thing in Belgium. So here in the United States, no, because we produce a lot of rebar, a lot of wide flange beams, and a lot of wire rod. All these things, you melt scrap, you produce it. But out steel for cars, particularly the highly specified exposed parts, only people like us can do. So they can buy from me, they can import from Japan, from Nippon Steel, from JFE, import from POSCO, from Korea, they can import from ThyssenKrupp or from Voestalpine. The problem is that I'm the only one here in the Midwest, in the middle of the plants. I'm in Dearborn, Michigan. I'm in Middletown, Ohio. I'm in Butler, Pennsylvania. I'm in Riverdale, Illinois. So I'm in the middle of car country. So that's the way it is. They are stuck with me.
You know, one thing that strikes me in this conversation, you are talking about all the stakeholders that matter to you. It's the employees, it's the customer, it's the environment in general, which is very clear in everything you're saying. And one constituency is left out, and I'm amused by it because it's frankly the constituency that Steve and I are a part of, not just shareholders. That's not where I'm going at with this. It's the financial services community. You took over a company that 7 years ago had real problems, had real debt issues. You have now seemingly made it impregnable, meaning you don't give a hoot when debt issues come due, whether you pay it off or refinance it. If the rates are good, you'll refinance it. If the analyst community doesn't say the things that you think they should say, if they're focused on the wrong things, you've got the cash with which to buy back shares, all while you've been buying competitors and building this integrated steel companies and buying ferrous metal, the scrap producer. I feel like you've taken the bull by the horns and said to the finance community, you don't give me what I want, so I'm just going to cut you out of the picture. I'm not talking about Steve and me and other shareholders. We're well treated. I'm talking about the capital markets providers.
And let me, since Jim meant to ask a question but clearly didn't, let me ask the question. Where do you think analysts and prospective shareholders get it wrong most often with the Cleveland-Cliffs story?
Yeah, I appreciate the introduction, Jim, and I appreciate the question, Steve, because that's a real good question. First of all, as a steel company, we are a baby because we were a mining company for 173 years. But we were a long-time mining company that was also doing everything wrong, because we were following what the research analysts were hinting towards what should be done. And that's why I ran a hostile takeover and took out the board and took out the CEO and everybody else and took over and changed everything. We sold Australia, we sold Canada, we sold coal mines, we sold chromite, we sold everything that was not iron ore and steel in the Midwest. And after I was just iron ore in the Midwest, I was able to buy AK Steel. That was my second largest client. And when I bought my second largest client, my first largest client, ArcelorMittal USA, realized that, and they sold to me. And that's how I got where I'm at. So you got to have a plan. And CEOs, usually, they have plans, but they are derailed by their boards, by the research analysts, by the press. I am not derailed by these things. That's why every now and then I have to rearrange the bus with the research analysts. I believe we are good now. Every now and then I have to rearrange the bus with the board. I think we're good now. And the shareholders, they come and go. I remember the day that I was watching here, because I always watch the halftime report during my lunch.
Can I ask a clarify question?
Sure.
Do you watch the show as often when Jim is on as when I'm on? Or do you use a little judgment in how often you watch?
I love the way, Steve, you talked over him just as he was about to insult you. Lorenzo, feel free to go back 15 seconds ago when you were about to insult Steve. That gets extra points on this show.
If I am sitting here at my desk, I usually have lunch at 12 noon sharp. I turn my TV on and watch you guys, whoever is there, even when it's Josh Brown and his Leslie Pool Supplies or Roblox.
Yeah, you're a real metaverse guy, an integrated steel company CEO.
Things like what we're doing today are very necessary because we need to explain our things. I believe that even the kids that are in college right now, they don't understand what steel is about. They want to work for a company to code, to write programs. They need to understand that these programs only exist because there are companies that use those programs that code. Same thing with the financial institutions. You guys were mentioning the financial institutions. I think the big names, they lose track very easily. You take Facebook right now. I remember when Facebook was IPOing. Oh my gosh, everywhere I was doing a bond deal and I was doing my roadshow at the time, everywhere I was going, I saw balloons in one of the Park Avenue's big buildings waiting for Facebook to come. What's that? Mankind got here without Facebook and mankind will survive after Facebook. Think about it. Yahoo was a big deal until it was no longer a big deal. So these things come and go. What doesn't come and go is the reality that people need to feed their families. That's why I think about my employees first. Driving through the Midwest is a learning experience. Transforming Toledo, bringing Toledo, Ohio back to life is my lifetime accomplishment. Putting Cleveland back on the map. By the way, we have a steel mill in downtown Cleveland, Ohio. Our air is cleaner than any state, any city in the United States. Los Angeles, New York, St. Louis, Houston, Texas, you name it. And we have a steel mill right here, 2.6 miles from my office. I see it from my window here at the office. So that's a lifetime accomplishment. We are proving that we can be a manufacturing country. We can have clean air. The manufacturing, that's the foundation for what comes after, automotive sales, the mechanical shops, the paint shops, the body shops, everything that comes with automotive can exist here in the United States. People can take care of their families. These people will buy things, and that's capitalism. That's democracy. That's peace. People don't care in a steel mill if we're white, Latino, or black, or gay, or straight. They just need to work together. That's democracy. So we need to bring this back. Steve was mentioning the Asians and Japan and South Korea and China. Do you know what they did at the end of the day? They just copied us. The headquarters of Nippon Steel that was put together in 1970 was a copy of the headquarters of U.S. Steel in Pittsburgh. They copied us so much that even the building was a copy. When I went there for the first time in 1983, I said, holy crap, this is very similar to the building in Pittsburgh. So China, they're doing exactly what we did. But there's a time lag. And we believe that we could be smarter and let's move to them and everything will be okay. No, we need to bring this back. That's what we're doing.
Lorenzo, that was an incredibly powerful statement. I think that we should wrap it up there because as we started this conversation, there was a question hanging over the atmosphere. Where is the economy going? And what you've told us today is that manufacturing, building things in the U.S. is coming back and that you see it from your vantage point on the front lines. And your vantage point on the front lines, you got to where you are and you're successful where you are by your empathy, by your understanding of what people need, what people want, what their dreams are. The individual, whether it's your worker, whether it's customers you sell to, whether it's just society at large. It's a hell of a message. It's a powerful message. And it's one that I think we're going to come back to over time and listen to this again and again. Steve, I don't know about you, but maybe let Lorenzo give one final comment.
I have one more question for his final comment. When you were growing up in the business as a young executive, obviously that you weren't staying in the Four Seasons, the Ritz-Carlton, you were staying in the Motel Sixes, the Holiday Inns. So you may be having flashbacks looking at Jim's decor behind him of what it was like when you were just living on the road. I've seen some steel sculptures, some steel art. Don't you think there's something he could do with steel behind him just to show that he is a man of prominence, that he has earned something instead of his college bookcase? And as I've said before in the show, somewhere there's this naked Holiday Inn room saying, "Where's my stuff?" And look no further than there. So is there anything you'd suggest steel-based art to help him out?
I would actually suggest that more investors would be like Gene Lebenthal, that was able to see something in this guy here, in this Brazilian guy, that was really upset in a investor's call. And he did not stop being, this guy's crazy because he's saying things that nobody would ever tell in a public setting to a very educated research analyst. But look, first of all, they're not the only guys that went to school and earned a degree. And second, if this guy's upset and he's trying to do something, maybe there's something more. He decided to spend the time and he became a shareholder. I believe we're a pretty big portion of Jim Lebenthal's portfolio. So I consider Jim one of my most valued shareholders. And Steve, I believe that today I convert another one. So that's how Jesus Christ did, one by one. So we'll get there. We'll convert all mankind.
I'm there. I've owned Cleveland Cliffs in the past many times. This is the longest period of time I've owned it. I look at it as not a commodity company. It's a value add company. So sure, there's going to be some up and down because it's just the way the market is. It's a cycle, but you've got some growth businesses here. I am a big believer in the EV cycle, and that is going to drive demand, particularly as range improves. So I was converted before this. You've doubled down on my conversion, though. So yeah, I will be with you for a long time.
By the way, I understand your position, and I respect your position. Every now and then I have to trade around your position. That's how you do it. You have been very clear about your current position with a lot more cash than securities in general. You have a point of view, and I respect that. But on the long run, we are going to be much better because reality always prevails. So a lot of these things that are not real will go away. But we are going to continue because we have 330 million people that we need to take care of in this country. And we will not have stability if we don't have jobs for everybody. It's like my first conversation with former Governor John Kasich. He said, "My biggest problem is the opioid crisis." I said, "Governor, with all due respect, your biggest problem is unemployment. If people are employed, they're not going to go with opioids because they are busy and they have families and they'll take care of their own business and they'll have time to go fishing. So they're not going to be doing what they're doing now. We need to bring manufacturing to Ohio, to the other states here in the Midwest. And that's what we're doing. And it's not a favor. It's in our own benefit. And the more we do that, the better we will be. We'll be more like how we were when we were the envy of the world. We can still be the envy of the world. Everybody's always ready to respect the United States. We are our own worst enemies. So we need to fix that. And we fix that manufacturing in the United States.
Nothing but gold in this episode. Lorenzo Gonçalves, CEO, Cleveland Cliffs. integrated steel manufacturer, important backbone of America, and giving us insight the whole time into where the future of our economy lies. It's in manufacturing, it's in building things, it's in going back to what America was known for and will be known for again. Thank you, Lorenzo. Can't thank you enough, frankly.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you, Steve. Appreciate very much the opportunity. All the best. Bye now.
Jim Labenthal is an investment advisor representative of Cerity Partners and holds the Chartered Financial Analyst designation. Jim Labenthal and Cerity Partners are unaffiliated with Stephen Weiss. The securities discussed in this podcast by Jim, unless otherwise stated to the contrary, are securities that Jim either manages within the current client portfolios or owned by Jim personally. You should not consider the information discussed as personalized investment, tax, or legal advice, or a solicitation to buy or sell any specific security. There's no guarantee that views and opinions expressed in this podcast will come to pass or a guarantee of future performance. Investing involves risk, and before investing, you should consult a qualified professional advisor. Stephen Weiss is not a registered investment advisor and is not affiliated with any regulated entity. The views and opinions he expresses are his own and are not intended to be advice or recommendations. Stephen does not guarantee the accuracy of his statements or views. Investors should perform their own due diligence and not rely upon the information contained in this podcast as the sole basis for their investments.